I really thank Tony for the introduction. It's great when one of your peers says it's nice things about you. It's the kind of thing I think you all in the room even understand when you're among your own peers and they kind of like what you do most of the time. It's nice to hear that. Tony, as you know, has been a valued member of the Oregon Legislature. You know that, not just in the field of the special interest. He's been the only Republican Senate member on the Ways and Means Committee and a member of the Emergency Board. And I read his name when he says no, and he knows what no means and when it's important to do so. So I thank you very much. I thank you for allowing me to come and speak to you. And I'll be talking in some general terms. I think it's important that you know basically what's in my head, how I'm going to approach things as governor of the state of Oregon. We can deal with specific issues, and I'll mention a few of them. But by and large, there are some things out there in the future you need to know if there's somebody there that at least understands the problem and would know how to deal with it. I think back now to a lot of bills in which I've been involved with in terms of agriculture. Agricultural chemicals were not a big thing to us in the early part of my legislative career. But we became concerned about agriculture itself and its health in our community and its real value to the economic health, not only of Oregon, but of course the food health of not only the United States, but certainly in the Pacific Rim area. I've been aware of the great jobs that have been done trying to sell Oregon products outside of Oregon, and the efforts, sometimes not too well recognized by the Oregon Legislature or the Department of Agriculture. But in recent years, this whole matter of agricultural chemicals and land use planning and things of this kind have kind of exploded on the scene. I want to make some comments in regard to it. When Senate Bill 100 was passed, which obviously affects agricultural land, there was also another bill that passed, Senate Bill 101. Not much is said about that, yet to me it was a very important piece of legislation. And I can recall the kind of lack of understanding of what's required in the agricultural area by members of the Oregon Legislature, dramatized by, and I'll mention his name, Keith Burns, who was the first administrative assistant of the Governor Strug. When we were dealing with Senate Bill 101, one of the features in the measure was the permission to practice agriculture as it is traditionally supposed to be practiced. And I can recall a section in the bill that would allow some variance from DEQ rules on agriculture. And this related to the noise from tractors, dust, manure smells, chemicals used on the fields. And it all related because homes were building close to farms. Keith Burns wouldn't buy that at all. We were going to destroy the environment. Can't let that happen. I said, Keith, you've got to allow them agricultural practices. You cannot say we're going to lock you in to agricultural land and then not allow you to practice agriculture. You know, he never understood that. He never understood it. And again, I want to remind you that that was the first advisor to the governor of the state of Oregon. Auspicious beginning, I might add, for the governor then. If I, you know, say a few little things like that from time to time, please excuse me. Another thought in regard to this whole area of agriculture. I was asked to participate in a seminar in Medford, Oregon. And the seminar was put on by the Jackson County Commissioners and the Extension of Oregon State University. Well, I was on the campaign trail in the primary, but I had a little time. I said, I want to go and listen to this. I knew what my role was, and my role was to explain the amendments to Senate Bill 570. But the seminar was Alternatives for the Preservation of Farmland. And I sat there and I listened. I listened to the attorneys in the LCDC. I listened to the attorneys of 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I listened to a group of people talking about the technical aspects of planning and zoning, and urban boundaries and agricultural land. And finally, it came my turn, which was just before lunch. And I went quickly through the amendments that we put into Senate Bill 570. But the message I wanted to deliver was, and it grew, I knew what I was going to say, but it grew as I listened. I said, you know, I've heard an awful lot about the appeals court decisions. And I've heard a lot about some of the things that we ought to be preserving in terms of farmlands and how we ought to do it from the intrusion of urban growth and how important it is. But you know, I haven't heard anybody talk about preserving the farmer, which incidentally was a new thought to them. You know, how can you preserve farmland if you cannot allow a farmer to stay on that land and make a living off of it? And I also reminded them, how did the farmland get there for them to preserve? There's a detachment by planters. To them, it's a red felt pen or a green felt pen or a blue felt pen or a yellow felt pen, and they have no concept that when they put that pen down on the piece of paper, there's people underneath that pen. In fact, never occurred to them that somebody came out and got their 160 acres, and they pulled stumps, and they worked very late. They got up early in the morning. They plowed the ground with some very, very ancient kind of equipment until it got better. They fought the whole matter of building their own home. There was a lot of body, sweat, blood. Families grew old fast, but they hung to it. And then the children took over, and they expanded, and they developed, and they improved upon it. That's how farmland got there. Again, kind of a new idea to them. They hadn't thought about that. And so when we get to thinking about, well, not only farmland, but certainly anything related to land use planning, it's very significant that we think in terms of people. Planners like to deal with charts. They like to put things on the wall, and if all the box and all the lines come down and everything is symmetrically good, they sleep at night. Somehow they don't relate to the fact that, oh God, the people in those boxes. But they don't really want to mess about it. They don't want to really get their mind all mixed up with those kinds of things. As I finished, the question and answer period came up. I won't describe the person that asked the question, but you can probably visualize that person yourself. He said, agriculture must be more energy efficient. Over in India, since they hardly use any energy at all over there. You know, I thought to myself, you know, that guy really means what he says, but I bet you anything in the world he wouldn't get behind a horse and a plow. He wants you to get behind a horse and a plow, but he didn't want to do it. We've got to save that energy. Again, this kind of foggy thinking that's going on. Field burning, agricultural practices. Very sticky situation. Here I'm campaigning for governor of Oregon, and so is the governor. And Tony and I know all the times we face the issue on the floor of the Senate. I've gone to Eugene and I said, look, let's consider the alternatives. Nobody I know of has considered the alternatives. I'm not talking in Eugene. I don't have bulletproof glass in front of me, but nonetheless, I'm talking to Eugene. I said, look, you say you want no more field burning, right?
Right.
Okay. Let's now consider the alternatives. What are the alternatives? Well, one is that you find another economical crop, right?
Right.
Okay, now can you find an economical crop for 180 or 200,000 acres in the valley? No, they really couldn't think of one. There is an economical crop for a few of those acres, but certainly not as you get closer to Eugene with that heavy soil. So I said, okay, the next alternative, that's not feasible, is that the farmer does nothing. He doesn't plant any grass seed, he doesn't plant any crop, he just sits there, pays his property tax and does nothing. Well, that becomes very obviously not an alternative. So I said, what's the third alternative? You can't plant an economical crop. You can't grow grass seed. What do you do? Well, subdivide. Well, that's not really what they want either. And so I said, look, what we must do is we must perpetuate this industry. We must let them burn. We know that we're coming closer to some kind of alternative decisions in this area, that it is possible to find something. I can't believe in my mind that there is not. In the meantime, let's all cooperate. Smoke management, I think, can be very successful, and we're doing a better job of it all the time. Problems appear, we find out what they are, we correct it next year. But I said what we ought to do also is ask some cooperation in terms of slash burning during that period of time. And we should ask industry in Eugene to cooperate that's using that airshed. Maybe cut down on their hours. They possibly can do it to help them cooperate. And I said also you drivers in Eugene should also cooperate. That, of course, is the least of the accepted versions of what I suggested. I was reading in the newspaper just Sunday, I think it was, and there was what they call, I think it was 6.5 hours of smoke intrusion in Eugene last year. That was a pretty insignificant figure, but what really I found very interesting that in prior years it had been something like 42 hours of intrusion. When I break down 42 hours, that's less than 2 full days. And I said to them in Eugene, you'll just love this beautiful green area for 10 months out of the year. You love to see the lambs romping around and the sheep out there. You just don't like it for 10 months out of the year. And incidentally, the grassy farmers don't really like it any better than you do. They don't really like to be in the news every year. What I guess I'm trying to lead to is this, that we need to always consider what our alternatives are. We cannot go off just shooting half-cocked and say we've got to stop something or change our ideas or change our movies just because that's the way it is for the moment. We must reflect, think, deliberate, come up with our alternatives, and then we can all solve the problem. Most classic of the kinds of things that have been going on is, and I'm sure most of you read the Sunday Journal, or the one which I have in front of me. I read it, gave it to my wife to read. She worries about some of the things I do from time to time. I said, here, read this, see if you feel better. And she did, and she did read it, and she did feel better. But you see, what has been going on in our society lately is that we have been pushed around by people who really don't understand what the situation is and who have been using politics instead of science. The classic, obviously, is the 245T issue. Classic, truly is. If you haven't read it, I would suggest that you do. But I made a few notes. I read the whole thing. Made a few notes. First of all, comment in this article that the chemical has been used in the nation's forests since the 1950s without measurable ill effects to man, soil, wildlife, or streams, according to the gist of 50,000 studies undertaken by scientists. So now we use it since the 50s. No noticeable effect. In the middle of the article, so scientists are still exploring the impact of a disastrous explosion July 10, 1976 in Seveso, in a manufacturing town about 13 miles north of Milan, Italy. Pardon me for rereading it, but I've selected it for those of you who read it. Selected some pieces out of it to prove my point. An unattended chemical reactor which produced 245T blew up and released into the open air a vaporous cloud of material 200,000 times more toxic than the spray in the forest. Before the inhabitants became aware of the danger, children played in the rolling plume. People continued to eat the fruit from the trees it had touched and lived in the nearby homes for 15 days before they were evacuated from the contaminated area. Dr. Richard Ellerby, a Portland physician and cancer researcher, said the spontaneous abortion rate was 11% for the next 6 months after this catastrophe, compared with 13% before the accident. Okay. Simple caffeine would be fatal at 10 to 20 grams, equal to that contained in 100 cups of coffee a day, Ellerby said. He said a person would have to drink 44 gallons of 2,4,5 tea with one part per 10 million of dioxin to achieve a lethal dose. Now I want to shift gears a minute, because now we get to a Dr. McNulty, who is with the Primate Center. Dr. McNulty at the Primate Center says that he sees, I was trying to get to the point I was, he sees little scientific value in the Cerveso explosion or other industrial accidents because, he said, the amount of the poison dose is unknown. 200,000 times, I guess, is not unknown. So he said, and information is incomplete. He said, more is learned from the controlled laboratory experiments. And then they all rest their case on his statement. It is conceivable that the use of dioxin-containing herbicides may pose a risk for some pregnant women. But as you read this whole article, it's abundantly clear. In the first part, the governor of Oregon stomps in. The Department of Forestry has been studying this deliberately and well, and received testimony. And if you read this, you can tell it's exceedingly well done. Good testimony. He stomps in and says, it's got to be 200 feet. And in effect, backed down the board, and they did adopt 200 feet. I want to read you a quote. They quote me in this too. State Senator Victor Attia campaigned for the governor's seat said, quote, my reaction as governor would be not to make a political decision in the use of 2,4,5-T or its proximity to water, whether 80 feet, 200 feet, or a quarter mile. These are political decisions, and I would stop all that nonsense and let the scientific people work out stream protection based on scientific facts. I say, what scientific basis does the governor of Oregon have for 200 feet? What scientific basis, in fact, is 80 feet? One scientific basis is a quarter mile. It's clearly obvious that's a political decision. And this is a crazy way to approach government. And when we're dealing with our trees, of course, but now you're talking about agricultural chemicals and what you're dealing with, a crop that's going to feed people. It's absolutely insane for us to be making political decisions in regard to the chemicals, pesticides, and herbicides that are being used. Makes no sense whatsoever. And I, as a governor of Oregon, am not going to be pressured into any political decision. I am not going to do it, whether advisory votes or not. It's important for the continued economic and human well-being of the state of Oregon. That's the only thing that really makes any sense. Fear controls facts. Fear comes out of ignorance, and I wonder if any of these people that oppose it ever read this article and what impact it made on them. Probably as they read this article near the end, they got the hodads and they believed that. I think it's important, really. And of course, I'm talking about agriculture, agricultural chemicals, forestry, herbicides, sprays, all this kind of thing. But you must understand that as we approach the business of running a government such as the state of Oregon, and nationally I might add as well, hysteria has no place. If we're going to do the right kind of a job, if a chemical is really dangerous and will harm human life, all of us want it banned. All of us do not want it used. None of us want to do that. We live here. Our children, grandchildren, children. We're living in this society. I am not out to commit suicide, and I don't want to commit suicide for my son or daughter or granddaughter. And I object, strenuously object, to anyone that thinks that I am less of a person than they are, just because I won't run off in hysterical facts. I really object to the elitists to think that they know better, somehow magically. One of the attitudes that's permeated this country, and Oregon's part of it, is that we have a perfectly secure society, and there is no such thing. Even when man was walking in the woods without a bear skin on, there was no perfectly secure society, and God nor man can create one. All we can do is do the kind of thing that we believe responsibly and reasonably will do it for us in this nation. And so I think as we proceed into the next 4 years, the voices that have been pushed down will be heard. I describe a wall around Salem, more appropriately described a wall around the Capitol building in Salem. And the reason I tell you that is that I have been all over the state of Oregon. I traveled close to 40,000 miles. I've been in every single county, and I've been in towns as small as Prairie City. I've been around the state, and I hear people in John Day and Fossil and Burns and Ontario and Lakeview and Klamath Falls and Brookings and Coos Bay and Astoria all say government doesn't care. They feel isolated. But you know, you think that just happens out there. People in Salem feel isolated from Salem. There is a wall around there. There are a few of the guards that are there determined to let the voices stay out. Because when they do that, they are the ones that can determine what's going to happen. And I'll be darned if I'm going to let that happen. It's time that we as Oregonians had an opportunity to speak. And if you'll pardon me as I close, a little bit more of campaigning, the one I use, and I really mean, and I say it because I mean it, that on November 8th, when the newspaper says that Vic Atieh was elected governor of Oregon, I want each one of you in this room to say that you got elected governor of Oregon. Because that's the way it ought to be. You should feel that now you will be speaking in the state capital of our state. It's significantly important to me that that happens. And I believe that will happen, and I know that's the difference between me and the present administration, amongst other things. So, although I've talked to you in general terms and only specifically in a few, I think you get the feeling of the attitude of Vic Atieh as a governor of the state of Oregon. That's probably more important. And you will have a voice. Now, this doesn't mean to say we're always going to agree, because I'm sure that's the case. And I think that's the case between any of us that have respect for one another, just whether it's politics or not. But you will know why I decide what I decide. It won't be any foggy decision. And once I make a decision, if I'm with you, you know that I'm going to be with you no matter what. You'll depend on it. You can depend on what I tell you. And that too is very important, and that too has not been going on. So, with that, I'm going to stop and have you ask me some questions, except to tell you that I feel very strongly. As a matter of fact, I'm going to change my slogan. The slogan says, it's time for Atieh. I want to change it. It's time for us. Thank you very much. Well, it's unfair to the counties that are not getting it. It's fair to the counties that are getting it. Craig, the initial reason for ONC was in lieu of payments that these counties did not get during that period of the Oregon-California Railroad and the time those pieces of property were taken off of the tax rolls. I suppose it's a question as to whether we've caught up now in lieu of, but there's a very grave reason why we ought not to really meddle too much in it. Washington County is an ONC county, but it's really academic in terms of our county. Very little revenue involved. But if we start messing around, there's some people in Congress right now don't want us in any of it. And if we start stirring that pot, I'm afraid that we may be cut off in the pass altogether. So, as I say, fairness is just maybe it happens to be where you come from. Yes?
One question you touched on briefly, but you didn't go into it. Back to Eugene and the crybaby down there. The question I've been curious about is why, if they really have a problem as they perceive it, they have no DEQ auto inspection as we do in the Tri-County area here for us. Now, if they really got a problem, then why is the shoe partially on their foot?
Well, I think that's one of the things we have to get them to realize, which is part of my message as I was talking to them down there, that they have to stand back a second and realize the value of that land, whether it's because it remains as farmland, whether it's because it provides oxygen from the green stuff, maybe it's because the kids like to see the lands, but there's a value to it. And that they are part and parcel of maintaining that. They really are. They need to, instead of fighting, they have to join the effort. And that's the kind of an attitude that I'd like to get out of it. It takes a while, because they have been brainwashed down there significantly. And that's the way they perceive it at the present time. I think someone needs to talk to them in kind of deliberate terms, as I did. I said, look at the alternatives. Consider the alternatives. And no one's incidentally disputed any of the alternatives nor the order in which I took them. I've not had anybody take me to task on those. So it takes time. We've got to reorient what has to happen. I don't think we'll do it for all of them. I made one suggestion, never was followed up. I said, really what you ought to do is for those people down there in Eugene, talking to the grass seed industry, that can get a doctor's prescription. In fact, that smoke does harm them asthmatically or whatever, or allergy reaction. That you buy that person a air conditioning unit for their house. And, you know, it'd be cheaper than anything else I can think of. And during that 6.5 or 40 hours, whatever it is, they could do that. Well, it was never followed up. I gave an answer. That's sort of like, what was it, Mark Twain? Incidentally, I'll tell you a little story because it relates to ballot measure number 11. When the governor came to us and he addressed the Oregon legislature and said, here, I've got an idea. And he said, no, you guys are going to have to decide what the limitation is, and you guys are going to have to decide how much you're going to give, and you guys, but I'll give you an idea. That story about Mark Twain and his friend in some desert down in California, and they were walking around, and his friend said, gee, if we get water down here in this valley, it'd be the lushest place in the world. Mark Twain says, no problem there. You dig a ditch from the Mississippi River over here, you get all the water you want. I said, that's not too bad. How do we do that? Mark Twain says, I don't know. I gave you the idea. You work out the details.
Yes, in relation to Measure 11 and Measure 6, there's a lot of concern, especially among the educators of our state, that if Measure 6 goes into effect, there's going to be just a drastic cut that will hit them directly more so than a lot of the other departments. And I just wondered how you feel, or say Measure 6 does go into effect, what is your stand on the education aspect of that particular measure?
If you assume that Measure 6 passes and there are no changes made in it, then I would say that schools can survive, but it would be very, very rough. But the same thing would be true of sewer districts and water districts and cities and counties and everything else. I don't make that assumption. That I make the assumption that 6 will pass, because that's my thought at the present time. But I don't make the assumption that the Oregon legislature nor Oregonians won't change it. That's what I suggested at the special session, that we clean it up and give it back to them and give a choice to clean up 6 or 6 as it probably was. The Oregon legislature had a rare opportunity to increase their credibility by an immeasurable amount by doing just that. We didn't do it. But let me just document for you why I think 6 will be changed. First of all, we know the teachers are against it. We know many state employees are against it. We know cities are against it. We know counties are against it. And believe me, as a candidate, I know that all the editorial people in Oregon are against it. Yeah. I never found out what an evil guy I was until I ran for governor of Oregon. But in any event, what I'm saying to you, that the political pressure is there. The problems with six are fairly evident. The major problems with six are very, very evident because it's been flyspecked very carefully. And so here you have a well-defined problem and political pressure. And I'm a governor, and I've already said in all my speeches and at the special session, we ought to fix up six. I've never, ever said six stays wrong. That all those put together, I think, will quickly pass. And I would guess that all of us as Oregonians will be facing an election to clean up six, latter part of February, early March. So I'm not making the assumption that six will pass and we won't do a thing about it. I'm making what I think is the best assumption. And in that event, the plan I proposed was a net cost or a loss to local government, cost to state government of $300 million. That's less than any other plan proposed. Even ballot measure number 11 cost $500 million. So it just becomes very clear what's going to happen. Legislature to make a change, and we don't believe Oregonians are smart enough to vote that change, and I don't believe either one of them. The governor last Wednesday, when we were debating in the Junior League, he said one of the major timber companies was going to save $1,400,000 in property taxes, and do you think that the legislature is going to pass, tax them back again? I sat there and listened to myself. I said, the guy just called us all a bunch of crooks. He just said that we're going to fold the big business because they were going to $1,400,000. I don't believe that. He may believe it, but I don't believe it. And I believe Oregonians will make that change. They're smart enough to do it.